impressive. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, what's interesting about what Barry's saying is that I can almost believe what he's saying, because what I've noticed, especially on 40 and 80 meters, is that Europe and most of Europe, whenever or even on 20 meters, I have to point my beam north of east to get the strongest signal out of Europe. And if the antenna is pointed more east than it is north of east, I could definitely see how the signal could drop off quite a bit, where a vertical on the other antenna probably gets a better, capture of the signal from Europe. But that's just a guess on my part from what I've actually seen here, is that, really to get the short path to Europe, you really have to be north of east to really get a good, shot on Europe. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Gentlemen. Yeah, before the comment, Glenn, if I was aiming an antenna for the shortest possible great circle path from Massapequa to Central Europe, make a guess as to what compass heading I should aim that antenna for. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, on my, let's put it this way, on my high gain rotor, the marking on my rotator right here for Europe is usually there's a, between north and east, it's usually somewhere between, 60 degrees is the marker on my rotator.
Okay, if I had a perfect Earth globe on your desk, and I got a piece of string in my hand, and I connect one piece of string on Massapequa, and one piece of string on the United Kingdom, and I draw it tight, what compass heading would the string be on that globe at Massapequa? Over to you, Glenn.
84 degrees. Mel's at 34 degrees. That wouldn't make any sense here at all, because in my maybe it's just the way I'm reading the degrees off my rotator. But in other words, it's north of east, Dick, for sure. I mean, I can even do that even inside of QRZ, which if you put in the European call signs, and I put in my call sign, from there, basically it draws the line for you, and you can pick up the direction there. But it's definitely north of east, pretty darn close to where my rotator setting is.
Yeah, Glenn, I just want to tell you, I look at QRZ a lot. They've been getting those beam headings wrong about 80% of the time, so watch out with those guys.
Yeah, let me reword the question, Glenn. When Charles Lindbergh took off from, I can't think of the name of the field now on Long Island, and he flew one continuous flight, the shortest possible path to the United Kingdom, what direction do you think he flew away from Long Island as a compass setting with reference to true north? Over to you, Glenn.
Roosevelt Field, 54 degrees to Ireland.
Well, Dick, let's put it this way. Every time I've taken a plane flight over to Europe, it always goes north. It goes up over Greenland, and that goes, the shorter path is over the top. If you go along the straight across distance, the Earth is fatter across the center, so it's always the shorter path is going north.
So that they don't have to be over open ocean so much.
Yeah, the shortest great circle path from Long Island to the United Kingdom is something in the vicinity of 50 or 60 degrees. That's the shortest possible path, great circle path. When we look at maps, a hell of a lot of people get fooled that England is close to the same latitude as us, therefore you think you would go dead east. That's a fact that you're looking at a flat map on a flat piece of paper of a spherical object called Earth. You draw a piece of string on your globe and you'll find out that somewhere between 50 and 60 degrees of compass heading from Long Island gets you to the United Kingdom, for instance. So the fact that you aim your antenna there and get the strongest signal beautifully correlates. That is the Great Circle Path. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I wonder one thing. Why do you consider inverted V to be horizontally polarized, not halfway vertically polarized?
Don, good question. If I had a ordinary dipole, I'm going to give you the answer in three steps. Step number one, I've got a dipole in free space, and I'm feeding it in a normal manner from the center. At one instant of time, the right-hand side is positive, the left-hand side is negative. I could, if I want to, put an infinite sheet of metal normal to the dipole, right down the center. I put a sheet of metal. It would not make any change in the characteristics of the antenna. The gain, the impedance, nothing would change. Now, if I tilt those right-hand side and left-hand side of the dipole down so that it has an inverted V to it, first of all, with that sheet of metal, I can decide to feed the right-hand side and throw away the left-hand side, and you and I call it a ground plane antenna. The other half is there, but it's a mirror image in the metal. If I tilted the right-hand side down with reference to the sheet of metal, I would be rotating the polarization clockwise. If I tilted the left-hand side with reference, counterclockwise, so to speak. Each half is radiating the signal equally. I'm getting a downward polarization right side, opposite polarization on the left side. Those two vectors, in other words, if I drew a vector, I don't like the argument I'm just giving you. Let me think about that one. I just shot a hole in what I was about to tell you. I'm not going to give you an exact answer right now. I know it's primarily horizontally polarized, an inverted V.
Okay, the question arises from the fact of Glenn's comment and Eric's comment. And this factor actually gives a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, you said while the machine timed out that it's confusing. That if you take... I know for a fact that the curved dipole that I've made, the curved Yagi antenna with the elements drooped down, I've measured the polarization of that antenna. It's fed in the center, and each of the elements curved down at a 45-degree angle at the tips, and it is a pure, horizontally polarized antenna. In the bore site, down the boom, there is no vertical polarization. When I look at it from the side, there is, and that's what I should have been telling you, a inverted V antenna, when you look at it broadside, is purely horizontally polarized. When you look at it end view, it is purely vertically polarized. So it is a compound polarization antenna, depending on how you look at it.
So then the comparison that was given by three gentlemen does not really reflect of what you say. Am I right or wrong?
Glenn had a pure linear polarized antenna that he is rotating with a motor on the boom. So when he says he's going from horizontal to vertical, I believe him. He's not using an inverted V. Over to you, Wesley.
Okay. Now, the last comment. We have inverted V antenna, and then we have a vertical polarization antenna. Is it fair comparison?
Yeah, when... that's a very good point. When Barry told us, N2MB, told us he's got this huge vertical V on his 70-foot-high, I keep calling it a windjammer tower, aero motor tower, that tower of his, what the hell is the model number on that damn thing? Anyhow, when he views that antenna broadside, it is horizontally polarized. When he views that antenna end view, it does have an extremely strong vertical polarization component. So although Barry felt that it was a horizontally polarized antenna, you brought up a very good point. You're transmitting a more complicated polarization than was first obvious. We should have caught that one, Barry. N2 Moon Bounce for any comment on this. K2RIW in the second half.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm looking at this thing in the direction that the vertical antenna should look vertical, and the direction that the horizontal antenna should look horizontal, even though it's a bit of an inverted V. Because I'm looking at this thing is pointed north and south, which means it's firing east and west. And it's the same thing I'm doing with the vertical. Its direction, where it's a pure vertical, is east and west on the vertical as well. So I don't know if that argument is valid. I'm not looking for stuff to the north or the south. I'm not trying to see South America or anything. And Australia and New Zealand, they're not very far. I mean, they're south of west, but not by a lot, you know. much that it should make the big difference, as far as I'm concerned, anyway. And also, Europe is about 60, 70, 80, 90 degrees, even more, you know, when you get into the parts of Africa. So that's really, I think, in my opinion, that's east and west, you know, for that antenna, anyway. I just got one little question on a dipole, okay? If you V the, you know, make it like an inverted V, you tell me it doesn't have any effect on the antenna's gain, you know, it doesn't lose any gain or whatever you call it. The pattern is skewed a little bit, but you're saying if you made a three-element beam and the elements were V'd like that, just like an inverted V, it wouldn't have any great effect. That's what you've told me. How far can you V them before they're too close together and they don't work right anymore? You know, because obviously 45 degrees must be getting awful close to that and too MB.
If it was a Yagi-like antenna, which has intentional directivity along the boom, and if you take each of the elements and went out an eighth of a wave to the left, an eighth of a wave to the right, and then bent them down pure vertical, and you did that on all the elements, believe it or not, that would be 90% horizontally polarized antenna, even though almost all the metal you've got in space, or at least a lot of the metal in space, is vertically polarized. That higher, that vertical piece of metal on the right and the vertical piece of metal on the left is a little bit like transmission line, twin lead, 600 ohm line, but in this case it's a 2000 ohm line. Because the current on the right side and the left side are almost identical in magnitude but opposite in phase and polarity, it cancels. I'm slowly concluding that the majority of real radiation in the near field is magnetic field. The magnetic field is a function of current. The center of that dipole has the current, it's launching the magnetic field, and it's a horizontally polarized field that it's launching. So I think you can bend them down real far. Your bandwidth will change when you do that. But at the frequency you tune it for, even though you have more vertical metal than horizontal, in the bore site, that antenna will be horizontally polarized. When you do it as an inverted V, and you look at it off the ends, though, you are looking at a vertical antenna. N2MB, K2RIW.
Okay, but if you took the element now and you turned it around, in other words, made it like a loop, okay? You didn't connect the ends of the loop together, you know, the two outer ones. They just came right close to each other, but they were never touching, right? So this thing is really a 360-degree loop, and it ain't very big. How would that affect it?
You have seen loop antennas, Barry, loop Yagis. Each one of those loops is very close to 360 degrees in circumference. And the bottom of the loop is usually screwed down to the boom. The top of the loop is a continuous piece of metal. You could go out there and file a fine slot in the piece of metal at the top, and I think it would make almost no difference. Let me think about that. I ain't sure about that one. Yeah.
Are those half-wave loops or quarter-wave or quarter-wave loops?
Loop antennas that are resonated, each of those loops is a full 360 degrees in diameter. Yes. A cubical quad or a loop antenna or
a cubical quad is a full-wave loop.
Roger, Dodger. A loop Yagi, each of those loops is essentially one 360 degrees, one full wavelength and circumference. Barry, go ahead.
Okay, but I'm not looking for a cubical quad loop. That's a full wave loop. I'm looking for a half wave loop. That's what I'm asking the question about. Not a full wave loop like a cubical quad.
Yeah, if the amount of metal you're hanging out there is only a quarter wave to the left and a quarter wave to the right of center, a half wave of metal, in that case you cannot bring the ends together. As you bring the ends together, you're adding capacitance, which is going to lower the frequency. And to bring it back to resonance, you're going to have to make them a little bit shorter. Over to you, Barry.
Okay, yeah, right. Now, the ends are not touching, of course. They're not touching, right?
Roger, Dodger. If it's only a half wave loop with an open at the end, they are not touching. Go ahead.
Okay, and you're saying to make this a simple half wave loop with the ends not touching, if you want this thing to be resonant, you got to make it smaller. That's what you're telling me, right?
Just a little bit smaller because of the end effect capacitance. Yes. You're building a kind of transmission line on those vertical pieces of this horizontal thing. It's horizontal at the boom, and it goes out there a little distance and then bends down. Your bandwidth is going to be lower, but it's an interesting method of construction. If it's only a narrowband service you desire, in my opinion, you could get full performance out of this, Barry. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know where I'm going with this. Okay. I had something else in my mind, but I'll bring it up later because I don't want to keep everybody waiting on this. Okay, sounds good. I may experiment with that this week, by the way, because that doesn't take up very much property. You know that.
So you're going to start making your inverted V a very steep V angle is what I think you're going to do. Is that true, Barry?
I'm going to make it into a little bit of a diamond, actually. Not my inverted. Yeah, my inverted. Well, it's not going to be. I'm going to take an 80 meter dipole, not two halfways in phase, just a simple dipole now. And I'm going to bring it around and turn it into a diamond. But the ends are not going to touch each other. They're going to go to an inflate, but they're not going to touch. And I want to see how that works. You're telling me that's going to be horizontally polarized. And it's not going to be too detrimental to its performance, is what you're telling me.
That's a guess on my part. Each of your halves of the dipole, are they going to be a quarter wave or half wave long? Barry, go ahead.
Oh, it's a half wave dipole, so each side of it's going to be quarter of a wave. You know, it's a half wave dipole turned into a kind of a circle.
Okay, I see where you're going. So by the time you build one of those diamonds to the north and one of your vertical inverted Vs, one to the north and one to the south, you feed them one at a time, you're vertically polarized, feed them in the center of their inverted V, halfway from ground to the top of your air motor tower, that's going to be a phased array, you're then going to talk about feeding it from the top in order to make it horizontally polarized. Is that where you're going, Barry? Fantastic.
Yeah, I can feed it from the top or the bottom, right? It doesn't matter which place I where I put the feed line. Shouldn't matter, right?
Roger, Dodger. So now, by determining where you feed it, either in the centers or the bottom, you're going to be a vertically polarized phased array or a horizontally polarized dipole-like thing.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Right. What I might do is make a long boom, put two of these things on it, and I might be able to turn it, or at least fix it in one direction and have a two-element beam that way. But you see, the advantage to that two-element beam is it takes a very little property.
And if it's got a good front-to-back ratio or it's got a null from front to side, there are times when you can cancel QR Mary with that one. Is that part of where you're going?
Yep, I'm primarily looking for front-to-back ratio. And this should give me front-to-back ratio. That's all I'm looking for with this thing. Nothing further.
There's something not quite right now. Each one of your vertical dipoles are a half-wave long fed in the center. If you now feed a pair of those, you're feeding a pair of half-waves in the so-called center, which is going to be the bottom. Isn't that becoming a full-wave antenna? Barry, go ahead.
No, I guess you don't understand what I'm saying. No, let's just take it from the top. I have a very stiff, sitting on top of my tower, I've got a dipole, 75-meter dipole. Okay, and all I'm going to do with this dipole, which is fed up the top of the tower, you know, all I'm going to do with it is just take the ends of it and start bending them down and bring them all the way around, make it into a big circle. Actually a diamond, because it's easier to create a diamond than a circle. So it looks like a quad element, you know, you would use on a cubical quad, but a cubical quad element is a full wave loop. This is a simple half wave loop.
I think I see it. And then that spreader at the top of the tower will be on a rotator, and the ends of the dipole will be hanging down by way of gravity, and now you can rotate the thing. Is that what you're saying?
You got it. Okay. Now you're starting to think. Yeah, you got the picture.
I think Far Rockaway is about to get the first EZ easily constructible, fully rotatable 80 meter dipole. That's a mouthful. Over to you, Barry.
Yeah, it shouldn't be very big. You figure, I mean, if this was a, this thing is going to be less than, it's not going to be 60 feet wide, it's only going to be 30 feet wide, right? If my head's screwed on properly, that ain't very big.
You've got it. Everyone thinks that all of the radiating element has to be parallel to the ground to be horizontally polarized. It's only the center high current area that counts. The rest of it can droop any way you want, and broadside, that will be a pure horizontally polarized antenna. Viewed endwise, it will have a lot of vertical polarization, but that's not bad. As you rotate it, you're rotating the pattern, and you're rotating the polarization. Unfortunately, you can't rotate one independent of the other, but that's going to give you another nice knob to turn. Over to you, Barry.
Yeah, and if the project works well, I'll try to make it into a two-element beam, which is the next step, you know. And if I've got enough real estate, maybe a three-element beam, you know. That's the plan. So I'm going to start looking at that on paper tonight just to see if there's anything wrong with it, and I'll bring it back to the TechNet next week. Sounds like a plan. Back to you, Dick, and 2MV in Rocky Way Beach.
You got beautiful weather out there, Barry. How come you're not going to be building it and giving us a report next week? What's slowing down this project? I'm having some fun with you.
Actually, I was planning on doing that. The weather is so nice here. My backyard's only got about a foot and a half of snow in it. And if I drop anything on the ground off my tower, I'm not going to see it until spring. But that's okay. I actually plan on doing that, seriously.
That beautiful tower of yours, do you pronounce it aeromotor or air motor? Over to you, Barry.
I really don't know. I was told years ago, and I believe, I got this from Ohio, and I believe the name was air motor, but I could be wrong. You seem to think it's aeromotor. I don't know why. Maybe you know something. You know something? I believe it's air motor because I believe I contacted the company who made it many years ago, who is no longer making this tower. For some reason, they said that they're not in the tower business. This is going back several years because the towers were too expensive and nobody would buy them. And I don't know why, because there's plenty of towers out there being sold.
I think there's a slim possibility there's two brand names out there in the old days, Air Motor and Aero Motor. I thought I'd heard of an Aero Motor, but it could be somebody's mispronunciation. That's a minor detail. Beautiful structure, and you've gotten your money's worth out of that one. I think you bought that way back in the late 60s. Is that true, Barry?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe it goes back pretty far. I had Rhone 25 before that, and then I went to Rhone 45, and I've got another plan now. I'm going to use the tower as a support for Rhone 45, which is going to go up much higher than the way this tower is now, because I think that would be an interesting way to start a tower out, you know?
If you've got to buy the tower, I'm wondering why you're using 45 instead of 55. If somebody's offering you 45 at a good price, go for it. But you get a lot more bang for the dollar out of 55. I'm a 55 user. I'm a Rhone number 6 user. And my goodness, what a comparison. I should have been putting up Rhone 55 a long time ago. So if it's not going to cost you an arm and a leg, I'd go for the 55, Barry. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question, and I'm actually scared to ask the question. A long time ago, you and I took down a whole bunch of tower, and I never picked it up from you. Is it still around?
I treat it with tender, loving care. I bless it every morning, and it's available.
I was almost scared to ask you that question. So now you know what tower I'm using. That's it. It's a done deal. Whew, I thank you for saying that. You really took a load off my mind when you said that, let me tell you.
You made a big investment to move that to my property. Those chunks of steel, at least half of them are yours, Barry.
Okay, so I guess the way this works is whoever croaks first, the other guy gets the rest of it, right?
I think there's 450 feet of it there. It's 43 inches on a side. How many feet do you need, Barry?
You said 450. I would settle for 220-something feet. I think they're 20-foot sections, right?
Yeah, 750 pounds per section, 20 feet tall each, 43 feet on the side. It's essentially Roan 83 is what it really is, Roan 83. And I don't think, though, with your location with reference to Kennedy Airport, they'd let you put up 200 feet of it, Barry.
Who said I was putting it up here, Dick?
Makes sense. Okay. You've got a better QTH. Go for it. Out of curiosity, is it 100 miles away?
It's going to be just about 100 miles. It's going to be upstate New York in Orange County.
Okay. Would you believe that you and I were doing that moving in 1986? Do you remember that?
I even remember losing a handy talkie out there, and you were talking to it so we could find it at midnight.
Sure do, and I think it was on the 450 band. You were a lucky guy because of the way you stood on that tower the next morning, and then the guy wire holding it up let loose. Good thing you weren't there at the time, because I guarantee when that wire let loose with the 30,000 pounds approximately of force that was on it, I think there's a chance that that piece of wire, when it let loose, may have broken the sound barrier, Barry.
Yeah, my only regret, and you know my regret, remember that beautiful aluminum beam that guy cut up into little pieces to take home because we went to lunch? Oh, God, do I regret that.
Yeah, we took this log periodic antenna made by the Collins Company, 86-foot boom, rated for, I think it went to something like 16 to 40 megacycles. I'm guessing it was something like 10 or 12 elements. And you and I carefully took it all apart, made a very nice pile at dark. We're going to come back the next morning and pick up and move it. And we should not have left it alone that night. We didn't realize what was going on. That place was being scavenged like those guys must have X-ray vision, because all night long, essentially without flashlights, they were picking up chunks of aluminum and chopping them up. So, yes, that particular Collins log periodic, and you can see one just like it when you look at the entrance to MacArthur Airport in Islip. Ever been to MacArthur Airport and seen that Yagi out in front? That's what you and I had in our hands. Back to you, Barry.
It's really enough to bring you to tears. That thing was worth a fortune. Oh, God, do I miss that antenna. Anyway, there was MACK Radio, Press Wireless, and RCA Global. Are any of those still in business out there at all?
No.
Comment?
I think all of them out of business because of satellites. Who is it with the person with comment? Start off with your call letter, sir, and name. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
And KC2QAQ with a comment?
Handle here is Gay Golf, Italy Golf, and it's November 2, Golf, Italy Golf, and I'll bet you we have the same comment. Yeah, they took down that log periodic in front of MacArthur. It's not there anymore. I guess I noticed it about a month ago, and I think it might have been gone a little longer than that. Anybody else might be able to confirm. And 2GIG.
Wow. So something like a month or two ago, if I understand you correctly, they've removed that antenna. They're no longer using it. I think that was used for long-range FAA communication when other kinds of communication failed. I think it was the backup antenna. And I guess you're saying everything is done by satellite these days. Is that your best knowledge? Go ahead, Gig.
I'm not really sure. It might have been removed as late as a year or two ago, but I only noticed it. I think I only noticed it about in the summertime, actually, late fall. That's what I noticed. It might have been gone before that, but not really sure. Perhaps somebody else can clarify.
I'm going to miss that antenna. That was a beautiful looking structure. KC2QIQ, K2RW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that antenna, Dick. I was about to say, from my office at work, I can actually see it out my window. And I don't think it's gone for good. I've been working in the Bohemia facility now for about a little more than 3 years. And occasionally they take it down for a while. I guess they do repairs on it or whatever it is, and they put it back up there. But my understanding is that that's for, long-distance communication. And I believe it's it operates somewhere around 5 megahertz for aviation, Dick, back to you. But I would expect it's going to be back up. They took it down somewhere in, I think it was the beginning of October, right around then. And then I would expect that when the weather gets better, we'll probably see it back up there again. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, one very strong clue, Glenn. When they took it down, if they left the tower in the rotator, then there's a high probability they're going to put it back. If they really were removing it, they would remove the antenna, the tower, everything, because I don't think it was used for any other purpose. From your recollection, when you see it every week, Glenn, do you think the tower is still there?
Well, I remember the antenna came off somewhere in around October, but I'll take a peek again tomorrow because, you know, it's, as I said, it's really just outside my office over there. I can see it out the window. But I will take a closer look right off Betts Highway and, get you that information.
Gig, from your recollection, you saw the antenna gone. Is the antenna still there? N2GIG, K2RIW?
The last time I drove past there, sadly, I don't remember seeing the tower because every time I do drive past there prior to it being removed, I always did look at it and think it was just a beautiful piece of, just a beautiful structure to look at. And one day I drove past there and didn't see it. I want to say that the tower is not there either, but I'll slide by there one day this week, too, and report back.
Hey, Barry, it looks like we missed out on a beautiful opportunity. If they remove that antenna and that tower, do you know anybody who might have been interested in a thing like that? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Well, I'm still pining away about the other one, so I guess you know.
We got to find somebody who knows what happened. Too bad we didn't know that was about to be removed. We could have made them a deal like we did the previous time. What Barry and I did was to realize that out at McKay Radio, or was it? Yeah, I think it was McKay Radio. But these six towers, each 100 foot tall, were about to be crunched up and converted into scrap. And the company doing the wrecking brought their bulldozer over to the tower, tried to crunch it up, and broke the blade on the bulldozer. And I talked to the guy and said, you don't have to do that. Just wait a few days. I'll take it away for you. And that's what I did. And then Barry was involved in that operation also. Okay. I know we finished the mailbag a long time ago. Those poor guys have gone to sleep. Some real good news occurred this week. Let me drop. I don't know if Paul is there, WS2N. Let me give him a quick shout and see if he is. WS2N, K2RIW.
S2N is here. Good evening, Dick.
Yeah, Dick, if you can, try to tell us how they made the observation, because I didn't notice anything. They just said which telescope they used. But how the hell do you make that observation?
Funny you should ask. That was the Kepler telescope that was put up about a year and a half ago and announced this week was two announcements. Number one, 1,235 brand new exoplanets have just been discovered. Some of them are called candidates. In other words, they've got moderately good confirmation, and when they make one more orbit, they'll have perfect confirmation, and they'll be discovering a few more. And of the 1,235 brand new planets discovered by the Kepler telescope, I'll explain in a minute how they did that, 54 of them are located in the Goldilocks zone. That means they're the right distance from their particular star, that they potentially have water in liquid form, and therefore we think the possibility of life. Because water in liquid form, the right temperature, because 54 of them are in the right Goldilocks zone. And let me pass it over to Paul for his report, and then I'll tell you how Kepler works. WS2N, K2RIW. Anything new in space, Paul? K2RW listening.
Okay, yeah, and they're halfway through with that mission. So there's a lot more to come from that. So we'll have to, we'll look forward to that one. Yeah, and that's only staring at one spot in space, Dick. What we need is a couple of more of these things. One small, small spot. So we're, you know, you imagine if you put up 10, 20 more of those things, what they'll find? It should be good. And then they'll have something to look forward to. Then they'll put up other telescopes to just focus in on the ones that they find. And they'll be able to find what kind of chemicals and everything else that's coming off of these planets. So, as far as something new, I know there was a spacecraft launch from California, another military mission that they just did. Let me drop it. Of course, that's unmanned, but that Vandenberg Air Force Base, terrific place. Originally, it was planned to have manned missions there, so I mean they're very well equipped for these larger size launches. But as far as the manned space missions go, we still have one coming up this February, and then another one coming up in I guess that's June. End of April is the scheduled next mission, I think, for the one that Kelly is going to be on, Mark Kelly. That's the fellow where his wife was shot there in Arizona, the congresswoman. His brother's up in the International Space Station now, halfway through his tour. That's a six-month mission. So then they have one other flight that just came on board. Congress approved not too long ago. We talked about that last week, and that will be the final mission, Atlantis, and that will probably be probably the end of June. Let me drop it. And as far as the unmanned missions, there's plenty of them to talk about. You got the Messenger flight that at the end of this year it will be going into orbit around Mercury. You've got the two Mars missions on the planet. One not going anywhere, Spirit, with two broken wheels. They're waiting to hear from that. They haven't heard from that one since March. But Opportunity is still trudging along. You have the Mars Global Surveyor up above the planet, acting as a repeater for those missions and doing its own investigation. It's a very large spacecraft, by the way, like the size of a station wagon, doing its job. You've got the Mars Global Surveyor. That's no longer operating in orbit. And now the Mars Odyssey, that's still operating on the drop it. So serving as a repeater. Another spacecraft going around the orbit of Mars is the Mars Express, built by the European Space Agency, also doing the same type of work, investigating a planet, and sometimes they'll use that for a repeater. These things are all set up for the future launch of Curiosity, coming up at the end of this year. That is a Mars landing mission. But we'll look forward to that. It's also a rover. So we'll have three rovers actually on Mars. If Spirit gets up and running, you'll have three rovers actually working and riding around on Mars at that time. So we're looking forward to that. And the moon, we still have one spacecraft from our country orbiting the moon, still taking pictures, but it doesn't look like any missions are planned there for any, you might have a couple of foreign countries actually trying to get there before we do, the way things are going. So we got to hope that things change here financially. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed that the astronaut is going to be going on the next space shuttle, even though his wife hasn't recovered. But that's the kind of family they've got. They've got their missions. He's done a whole lot of training for a couple of years, and I guess he appreciates the fact that NASA would not rather have that all of that training wasted and start off with somebody else, even though there was a standby person. That person is only probably partially trained as much as he is. To answer Barry's question, how do you do that? Let me drop. Kepler is a good-sized telescope, a little bit smaller than Hubble, to my knowledge. It's in orbit around the Sun. It's not in orbit around the Earth. It is sticking out there in front of the Earth's orbit. I think it's at a Lagrange point, but it's out in front of us, so to speak. And it's aimed at one particular point in the sky, and the amount of sky it's looking at is a little bit bigger than the area of the Moon. So the telescope is continuously staring in one direction only. And it's staring at more than 100,000 stars that are in that little chunk of space, plus or minus a half a degree or 1 degree, in that order. One chunk of space, a little bit bigger than the Moon, is what it's looking at. There's a little more than 100,000 stars there. When a planet goes around one of those stars, and you happen to be at just the right angle that the planet passes between you and the star, it's a blockage to the light coming out of the star. Kepler is looking at any change in the brilliance coming out of each one of those stars that has the very characteristic curve. Let me drop. The very characteristic curve is as the planet starts passing in front of the star, you'll see the star's light slowly dim with a particular curve to it. While the planet goes in front of the star, you'll see it stay down to that lower dimness level. And then as the planet exits out of the right-hand side of its orbit, you'll see the light coming out of the star go back up by this exact same characteristic curve. And particularly if they wait until the planet goes around the star a second time and does the exact same thing one more time, now you've got a pretty strong confirmation. See, the telescope itself is looking at stars that are so darn far away. You are not seeing the planets. The planets are too dim. It's like trying to read the imprint on the glass of the front of a headlight while that car is coming toward you. You know, the brilliance ratios there are just so extremely high, millions to one, you don't stand a chance. Let me drop. So, Kepler has got a very accurate radiometer-like thing. It can measure any small change in the brilliance, apparent brilliance of a star when a planet passes in front of it. I just did a calculation for how easy it would be for Kepler. If Kepler was out there instead of near us, and it's looking back, how easy would it be for it to detect the Earth? The Earth is an 8,000-mile diameter planet. The Sun is roughly 900,000 miles in diameter, and we're 93 miles away from it. The bottom line of all that is that if you're in the plane of the orbit of the planets going around the Sun, then you will see the Earth. You'll see a number of the planets, but you'll see Earth for sure. If your location is a little bit above that plane or below that plane by 1/4 of 1 degree, then the Earth will no longer line up and give you a shadow on the Sun, if you know what I mean, and you'll miss it. Plus or minus 1/4 of a degree out of plus or minus 90 degree capability. That's one chance in 330 to be exact. So the proper alignment for them to be out there in the right place to look back and see the dimming of our Sun because of the Earth passing in front of it. There's one chance in 330 they'd be in the right place to see it if they had the right instrumentation. So with those limitations on these 100,000 stars they're looking at, they detected 1,235 planets so far using a technique that only sees 0.3% of the planets because of the orientations. That means the total number of planets out there is 330 times higher than that. N2 moon bounce. What do you think about this, Barry? K2RIW.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. The chances of getting the measurement, you just said, were 1 in 330, which is it. But it's it's a very small number, so we're missing most of them, obviously. Yeah. That's what I was wondering when you... Yeah, okay. Got it. Also, I would imagine that the planet has to take what I would call a direct hit. It has to go right across its sun, you know, as we're looking at it. If it's skewed a little up and a little down, you're not going to get the same reading. It's going to appear that the planet is smaller. So how do they compensate for that? Because, you know, getting a direct line across the planet, that ain't so easy.
Hey, Dick, WS2N.
Globe to Pole in a second. You made a guess, Barry, and it's not like that. The Earth, if you're standing a long distance out in space, and you're looking back at the sun, our local sun, the Earth is a round, black object drifting across that bright disk. Whether it drifts across the sun right at the equator, from your point of view, or if it drifts across the sun 40 degrees north of the equator, that doesn't change the amount of brilliance while the planet is in the middle of the solar disk. It just changes how long you see it. As the angles get such that the Earth is crossing across the sun at higher and higher meridians, higher and higher latitudes, you see it for a shorter period of time. But the amount of dimming is exactly the same, per se, because the sun is a bright, round disk. There's a little bit of dimming at the limb, but that's also part of the characteristic curve, if you know what I mean. The length of time it crosses tells you something about how big is the orbit. The shape of the curve tells you something about the size of the planet. And so, and it's a one chance in 330. So 99.7% of the planets have not been detected by this technique. The total number is 330, higher than the number they measured, and they measured 1,235 of them. Looks to me like there's a lot of planets out there, and 54 of them are believed to be in the Goldilocks zone. WS2N, K2RAW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good. We need to have the same math. That would be good, too. Goldilocks zone and the same math. I just want to comment, it's been a couple of years since that thing's gone up. I think it just has meters on board. Really doesn't have like a big mirror, you know, like the Hubble. It's not like a real telescope. It's loaded with these photo detect type of gadgets. You know, thousands of them, or maybe even millions, where they could detect the light dimming and brightening. Do you remember reading that thing?
It is a real parabolic mirror telescope, Paul. It's a real telescope, and the focal plane array has a very large number of individual charge coupled devices built up into a whole bunch of little individual patches, so to speak. And each one of those photo detectors on each one of those patches is a photometer. In other words, it's making a very careful measurement of the total brilliance of each one of those individual 100,000 stars. You need a real telescope, Paul, in order to have the angular resolution that you're picking out these stars one star at a time. And I think that focal plane array, I believe they occasionally rotate it 90 or 180 degrees in order to balance out the fact that some of those individual detectors may be a little bit more sensitive and a little bit less sensitive.
Dick, how long does the dimming period last?
I think the dimming period lasts for something like 1 hour. You and I can easily calculate, knowing the diameter of the sun, knowing how far we are in the orbit, 93 million miles. The sun is roughly 900 million miles in diameter. We go around the sun once in 365 and a quarter days. You go through that mathematics and you find out that the Earth, from a very far off observer in the right plane of observation, we'll see a dimming of the Earth for something like 1 hour. I'm not sure if it's 40 minutes or 90 minutes, but it's in that vicinity. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, and of course, to make the observation again would take approximately a year if we're going by something that's in the same area, you know, that the Earth is from our sun.
Dick, we're going 65,000 miles an hour, so that's all it would be, 1 hour?
At that number of miles per hour, how long does it take to cross across the sun's disk of 900,000 miles? Over to you.
Okay, yeah, well, I guess, yeah, at a certain... close in distance, I guess it would seem longer, but when you're far away, it's going to be shorter, is that it?
When you're off at infinity, there is no parallax. All lines coming from that planet, all lines of shadow coming from the Earth, everything is parallel. When you're off at that long a distance, there is no parallax.
13 hours.
No, the answer comes out to be about an hour. I think we're moving at something like 19 miles a second. So how many seconds does it take to cross 900,000 miles is what I'm doing right now. Exponential 3, enter.
And they got to come back same time next year to make the measurement again, right?
You got it. I think we're moving 19 miles a second. That's that many seconds. Divide by 3,600 to convert seconds into an hour. And it comes out 13 hours. I thought it was about an hour. Maybe it's 13 hours. We'll check on the mathematics, but somewhere between an hour and 13 hours is the amount of time it takes for the sun to walk across the center, the Earth to walk across the center of the sun from an observer at an infinite distance, so to speak. Anybody got any further comments on this? K2LAW?
Yeah, after 65,000 miles an hour, because I'm positive of that, it's actually 66. So does your 1 second conversion, well, you're better at this math than me. You got the calculator there, Dick. Does that work out to 66,000 miles per hour? If that would be right.
I'm going to assume it's 65,000 miles an hour and 900,000 miles, exponential 3, 900 exponential 3, and therefore the answer comes out 13.8 hours, same number. Looks like the answer is 13 hours. So the Earth crosses in front of the center of the sun in 13 hours. That's if we go right across the equator of the sun. So as long as your photometer does enough averaging during that 13 hours and maybe rotating its focal plane array periodically and averaging, it's a very small amount of dimming. I mean, the sun only wipes out, the Earth as a shadowing device only wipes out a very small amount of the sun. But Kepler is made to look for these very small changes. And at the same time, by the way, it's looking for other periods of changes that represent the sunspot cycles of those particular suns and their rotation rates. They're getting a lot of data out of this thing.
Yeah, and their eclipse time that they're measuring, that's how they're determining how far the planet is from its sun, right?
I think the answer is yes. As you get a planet that's further and further away, the eclipse time will take longer and longer. That's on the assumption that you know the size of the sun. You know the size of the sun by the amount of light it's putting out. You know the, by looking at the spectral quality of the sun, in other words, how much helium and how much hydrogen it's got and whatever, you know what spectral class it's got. So they're making a lot of measurements. It is a real telescope with a whole lot of individual focal plane elements making these very precise measurements. But as a method of finding how many extrasolar planets are out there, this is by far the way to get the most amount of information in the least amount of time. So in approximately 2 years of operation, 1,235 planets so far and counting, by a technique that only counts 0.3% of the possible planets. K2LAW listening.
Yeah, do they have any way to determine how fast the suns are rotating and how fast the planets around them are rotating? Have any ammunition for that at all?
Once you know the size of the sun, the star, once you know the size of the star, you know how much gravity it's got. Once you know how much gravity it's got, you know exactly what velocity each planet's got to get once you know the radius of the planet, you know, the distance of the planet from its star. You know the distance from the planet from its star by how long it takes to cross across it. So you've got enough raw data to figure it all out. It's very similar to what happens with the fact that
I'm not discussing the planet's orbit.
I
wanted to know the planet's speed of rotation. Its actual, you know, its night-to-day rotation.
I don't think you know that,
on that, Dick.
What's that, Paul? I don't think you know that. What'd you say, Paul?
on that. They have a spectrometer hooked up to this thing, and there's a some kind of a different signature that they get, and then when it rotates, they notice one side is becomes hotter, and you know, and then the other side is cooler, and they're able to tell the spin ratio, something to do with the spectrometer.
Do you think they're measuring the spin of the star or the spin of the planet? Back to you, Paul.
I just saw this. It was the spin of the planet. It was a special, I think, on the Science Channel regarding this topic.
Yeah, Barry, if you Google the word Kepler, Kepler telescope, you're going to find a lot of good NASA information on this one. And so I'm convinced there's an awful lot of life out there.
Okay, I don't think you could measure the spin of the planet that way, because I think if the planet was spinning at all, it would be equally heated all the way around. You wouldn't see any variation in that if it was spinning.
Yeah, when it comes to the spin of the star, I can think of various techniques where they can detect that. But when it comes to the spin of the planet, and whether or not you're getting a positive and negative Doppler shift of the light coming off of the edge of the planet, I'm having a problem with that one. When it comes to the rotation of the planet on its axis, I'm not convinced that they're detecting.
That, I think, would have something to do with whether there's life on that planet or not, because if you don't have a night and day cycle, or you have a very slow one, or you have a very fast one, I don't think that's too conducive to life. So you got to sort of get it into a range as well. You know, also has a lot of effect on the weather on that planet.
Do you know that the rotation of the Earth used to be about 3 times faster than it is now? How about you, Barry?
Yep, I sure do. And I don't think when it was that fast there was any life on it.
Earth is roughly 4.5 billion years old, and a small fraction of 1 billion year, there was already plenty of life on this planet. I'll admit it was rather primitive microbial life, but life formed on this planet very soon.
Okay, I accept that. N2MB.
WS, do you want about that spectrometer?
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
What this woman, she's in charge of the Kepler, said was when the star gets beyond, in other words, it's in front of the sun, but then when it goes past, you know, past the disk, so now you're looking at the planet when it's past the disk, as it's spinning, the planet has, you know, you're looking at the planet, and it gets hot, and then it gets cold, and hotter and colder, not in front of the sun. I think it was something along those lines.
Okay, that makes some sense. So, I didn't think they could resolve the individual planets, but on the assumption they can, once the planet gets way off to one side of occulting the sun, then as the planet rotates, let's assume that it takes 13 hours to go across the face of the star, and you look at it 45 hours later, where it's way off to one side, but you're still looking at the dark side of the planet. If you can resolve the individual planet, and you're looking at its dark side, as it rotates, one edge is going to be hotter than the other, because that edge just experienced sunset. That's what I think Paul is saying. Does that make sense to you, Barry? N2MB, K2RIW?
It didn't when Paul said it. It's beginning to make sense now, but I got to think about it a little bit because something don't smell right there.
I wish I could think of the show. It was specifically about Kepler, Dick. And she was in charge, and she made a big deal out of it, saying, here we are looking at these planets, and not only can we tell, you know, everything that you mentioned about them, we could also tell the spin of the planet, and then I believe it was due to the spectrograph that they took. Not sure, but they're doing it, and I'll have to check the computer to find out how, you know, more about that. But I know they're doing it, just can't say for sure how they're
fun project. And we're going to discover that there's a lot of possibilities for life. There's a lot of planets. There are many astronomers now assuming, estimating, that something better than 10% of all stars have got planetary systems. That's a lot of planets. Because you've got 4 times 10 to the 11 stars per galaxy.